WPFW.org. Thanks.
At 89.3 FM, this is member-supported WPFW, Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller. Joining me in the studio today is Fred Joyner. Fred Joyner is a poet. He's the co-founder of the Center for Poetic Thought. From 2007 to 2012, he was the creative writing editor of Words, Beats, and Life. Lately, Fred has been living in D.C. as well in the African nation of Mali. Great to see you, Fred.
It's great to see you. Thank you for having me.
Good. You know, I want to begin with something that I think would be very important to some of our listeners. You received a fellowship back in 2014 from the D.C. Commission for the Arts and Humanities.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, how important was that fellowship to you, and what did you use the money for?
Well, it was very important. It's very important, not just because it's money, but it's a type of validation. When you arrive in a city, or when you're from a city, and you feel like you infuse that kind of like energy into your work, it's good to have that kind of validation, kind of like a response back to the call that you put into your work. So it meant a lot to me. As far as the funding, I put that into a small little fund to help start the Center for Poetic Thought. Without that kind of funding, I wouldn't have had the seed, kind of like the seed money to start the Center for Poetic Thought as a partnership with the American Poetry Museum, and, you know, as a collaborator with all the people.
Now, how did you know the commission was out there? Because I remember many years ago when we were trying to get people to apply, people said, well, I didn't know that the commission was out there.
Yeah.
Well, did you have contact with other people?
With other writers. You know, my first kind of like, how I got introduced is, another writer who's in New York now, who's here at Howard, who was at Howard, John Maria, won a, Larry Neal Award.
Right.
And that's the first time that I kind of like heard of it, you know, some years ago. And I was like, wow. And so, you know, and then you start, you know, when you listen to stations like PFW, or you look at, flyers for certain things, you see like DC Commission on Arts and Humanities. I was like, oh, okay. So it was always, as a government, you know, arts commission, it was always, since then, it was kind of on my radar, right, as, wow, they give an award for poetry?
Right. Now, you know, you got to put this application together.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, in terms of writers, especially African-American male writers,
sure,
do you put together your Sidney Poitier poems?
Because
you want the money?
Yeah. You just try to be as honest as you can. You know, because I've been fortunate enough. I placed in the awards twice. But you know, that was probably like, you know, it was one time I applied and it's like, oh, you know, it's so
But what I'm getting at,
yeah,
you have a body of work.
Yes.
You make the decision, you're going to apply to get some money. There must be a thing where, well, should I put this poem in the package?
Oh yeah.
Can I leave this out?
Definitely. No, I mean, I think what I always tried to do was show some kind of range,
okay,
you know, so yeah, it's just range. You know, I don't want them to be all the same kind of poems about the same kinds of things. It's like a mini manuscript in a way. You're trying to show some kind of range. You're trying to get some kind of energy into the manuscript that you offer to the commission, to their panel. So yeah, that was my approach, is range.
Let me ask you the big question,
sure,
and that is, should we be giving money to Fred Joyner? And when I'm getting at the whole thing in terms of getting, you know, taking money from other issues that we're dealing with in our society and say, okay, we're going to fund the arts. How important is it to fund the arts?
I think it's very important to fund the arts, because I think, and you know, I've been thinking about this quite a bit, for artists in a growing city, one of the questions that we have to start to grapple with as we look at how gentrification advances and just displacement advances is ownership. we should be trying to create opportunities for artists, not just to occupy certain spaces when that's a profitable thing or when you're trying to build a community up. Artists should be able to own homes, own studios. It's nice to rent. That's very nice. We're thankful for those opportunities, but I do think we should be paying artists in a way that helps them to own and help to make them permanent fixtures in the community rather than just kind of like here today and gone tomorrow when, you know, another kind of when another crop is ripe, you know, when the condo crop is ripe.
Right. You've been in and out of the city, so I don't want to give you this sort of Rip Van Winkle question, but you know, how has the city changed when you come back? I mean, in terms of the literary city.
Wow. Honestly, I think it's gotten a lot richer. You see a lot more voices. People are now, you know, because of like the visibility of DC writers. And not only that, but now because of the internet and because of all the technology, people can start to trace the lineage of where certain writers can come from and where they became, you know, kind of became writers. So when you look at somebody like Gary Lilly Copeland, right? Or Gary Copeland Lilly, you know, he, not to say that, you know, DC was everything, but he made a name for himself here. John Murillo, Reginald Dwayne Betts, you know, people like Jane Alberdestin, you know,
right.
You know, Holly Bass, who's been to Italy and back, you know, all these people have DC in their literary DNA. And I think now that technology is able to help people trace that lineage, people are looking at DC and as a destination to be a writer and to be a writer engaging with the world.
Well, you know, we always say that about the Harlem Renaissance, but most of the writers were here in D.C.
Well, I mean, yeah, it was the seed for the Harlem Renaissance, right? And those of us who look at the DNA, we know this,
right?
That intellectual seed was really here in Washington.
Look at your DNA, Fred. Back in 2014, you were discussing something called African American male poetics. I want you to expand on that.
Yeah, so as part of a graduate school project, and not just that, but it kind of came to a head for a project that I was working on for graduate school. And basically, the title of a seminar that I gave was the idea was really to try to capture what is happening new in African American male poetics. Is like it's not all this kind of like one dimensional rage that we're used to thinking about Black men, African American men speaking about. But if
give us some of the names. Where does it? What rights would you associate with that rage?
Oh, I mean, of course, I was dealing with Baraka, but I also looked at a poem from Julius Lester, from an anthology that Dr. Jeffrey Coleman down at St. Mary's College, because I looked at one of his poems. I looked at I actually looked at a Quincy Troup poem, because you know there was the Magic Johnson poem, which I think is a very clever pun, right? When we know about African American vernacular language, you know, so I was looking at a Quincy Troup poem. I looked at I looked at Terrence Hayes. I looked at I also included some of my DC, you know, I looked at Derek Weston Brown. I looked at Alan King.
And what are you seeing in some of these people?
Well, because the thing is like, so for instance, the Julius Lester poem that's in this anthology that Jeffrey Coleman put together, there was kind of like this piece in the poem where it was talking about rage, and it was saying like, if we do the, and I'm paraphrasing, I can't quote it, but he was saying, if we are going to embody this rage, let the generations that follow kill us for not having been more perfect and loving. And I thought that was really interesting, because he was like, look, the time that we're in right now is a time of rage. This was during the civil rights anthology that Coleman put together. So it's very telling. He was saying, yes, this rage is happening. I need to deal with this, but let the generation that comes after us kill us.
But let's look at what happened. And that word rage, if we go back and monitor media, we saw that word used a lot last year. You know, when we looked at Baltimore, it seemed like it came back into our vocabulary.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm saying, okay, we see in the 60s, look, people that you were looking at, what happens in between? Did we have the rage, lose it, and it comes back again within this vicious cycle?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that the systems that kind of like that we're dealing with never kind of stop. But I think what happens is you have a certain class of people that are constantly dealing with the conditions that make for a rage response, or what can be seen as a rage response to the conditions of their lives.
Okay, let me keep it within the confines of literature.
Literature, sure.
You're talking about this African-American male poetics and sensibility. Mm. We also look at, from the 70s and 80s, the rise and increase of African-American women writers.
Yes.
Okay? To the point they almost dominate the literature. Okay? But we also know that these women writers, because they emerge, mm-hmm. affect male writers. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at some of the male writers that are coincided with their success, mm-hmm. I'm talking about like an August Wilson, mm-hmm. others, you see the development of their female characters.
Sure.
So I'm looking at this dialogue and conversation, because now when we look at all these writers who are out there, men and women, what kind of dialogue are they having?
I mean,
we're reading each other's work.
Yeah, right? Sure. I'm not sure. To be honest, I'm not sure. It's something that I think, from a scholarship perspective, probably deserves our attention and some real focus. I mean, that's one of the things I appreciate about you, Ethelbert, is like you always ask these kind of questions that point towards where our scholarship should be looking, because I do think that in the effort for visibility, in the effort to be heard, you're grinding, doing the work, and not thinking about how the work is going to be framed or be seen.
I think that's
I know I'm not totally answering your question, but I'm pointing towards the effort and scholarship that I think needs, because we really do need to look at that.
Yeah, and what I was looking at is that if you look at how Zora Neale Hurston came back into the canon, you look at the work of Alice Walker and Ntozake Shange, I took the position that if I was a young girl coming of age and reading that work, mm-hmm. it changes me as a woman.
Sure. Okay?
And I felt that if women or African women are reading about, you know, tea cake, you're going to have a tea cake. For them to date.
Yeah.
And what happens, right. It means it puts a different pressure on our community. Mm. So now we have to say, okay, what is going to be the response of African American male writers? Mm. If the women are creating these characters,
yeah.
And what are the male writers doing?
What are they writing about?
Right. And that just brings me to you as a father of two girls. How will they look at their father's work?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, for me, and I think things are changing for me. You know, I wrote a poem just recently, you know, that I'm drafting right now about the experience of like holding my daughter and thinking about the drum, right? But the only drumming I need is me patting my daughter on the back. Like, there was a time when, you know, being at the drum circle was everything for me, right? Or being right. in a place where a certain kind of music was being shared. But now, you know, in kind of the space that I'm in right now, the only drum I need is holding my daughters and patting them on the back when they, you know, when they're having an issue, to settle them down. So yeah, it does change. It does change.
Well, talking about changes, one of the things that we've seen in terms of changing within African-American literature and culture has been the rise of Kaveh Khanna, mm-hmm. you know, which is a Definitely. Wonderful workshop that was developed back in 1996 by Toy Derricott and also Cornelius Eady. Mm-hmm. So many African-American writers have benefited from these workshops. I find it interesting, you were never a member of Kaveh Khanna.
No.
Okay? But you've hosted events for the school. Mm-hmm. I think that places you in a very interesting position in terms of looking at this organization from outside. Hmm. What's your take of it, looking back over these last several years?
Because I haven't, you know, attended, doesn't mean I don't feel like I'm a part of that community, because, you know, a lot of that inaugural class were DC writers that when I arrived to DC, these were my kind of like, they were my community.
Right.
Folks that became part of my educational process as a poet. And I say this, I probably don't say this enough. But people like Ernesto Mercer, people like DJ Renegade, people like Brandon Johnson, Brian Gilmore, Holly Bass, like these people were part of my education as a writer. I just recently did my MFA, but I did it. I think that the education that I had before that prepared me for the MFA, and no knock to the program that I went to, but it was in some ways it was easier because I had that kind of grounding. You know,
did these individuals share with you in terms of, did you see their transition from going to CopyCon and coming back?
I didn't, because when I arrived in DC, they had already returned. But from what I had, when I talking to people in the community and kind of piecing together the history, you know, it was noticeable that there was a difference. You know, they came back with reading lists. They came back with, oh, Toni Asante Lightfoot. I cannot forget her. She's another one that, you know, with Mangoes and It's Your Mug, and like, she's another one part of my education. I'm going to forget many names. So I did not want to miss her. But it was something that was talked about, the transition into the new space of bringing back what they learned. But I didn't personally witness it.
I want to explore this is because, when we look at how some of our African-American writers, emerge, they don't come out of workshops.
Right.
They come out of, you know, friendships with people, you know, who have an interest in reading, they share a book, you know, hang out in different places. But now all of a sudden we have something that's completely different. We have a place where people can go. We have a destination. Okay?
Right.
We have people who apply to CopyCon and don't get in. Okay?
Right.
When CopyCon people come together, it's like a little group, and if you're not part of the group, you seem like you could be an outsider. And I'm wondering whether now, and this comes to your experience during doing workshops, is it possible to workshop the Black experience?
Ooh. I think, wow, that's a heavy question, because then you have to have a conversation about appropriation, because then the question, a level above that, is can only Black poets workshop the Black experience?
Or can you distill it?
I think it can be distilled, but I'm not sure. Like, yeah, that's an interesting question. I think the experience is kind of like a lens, right? And I think there has to be a certain amount of experience that you have with the Black experience. It's not like I went and did my PhD and now I can use this lens, right? No, I think there's a certain amount of experience. There's a certain amount of engagement that you have to have with the Black experience, with the African-American experience, to begin to try to filter through those. Like, to give you an example right now, right? Like, people are talking about Beyonce's Lemonade, this movie that, and, you know, I've been seeing, you know, clips, different news clips. And somebody said, you know, there's a line where she says, Becky with the good hair. And I remember the publication, but they're asking, somebody in one of these publications asked, well, what does that mean? Right? So they're writing about an artist that's part of the Black experience, but they don't have all the tools that they need. And I don't know the race or gender of the person who was writing about this, but whoever it was did not have all the tools that they needed to decode that. Right? So we can say, yes, anybody can, it can be distilled, it can be workshopped, but what I need, if I'm going to be attending this workshop, I need to know that somebody has the tools, has the toolkit,
right,
to be decoding certain kinds of especially when you're talking about African-American poetry, African-American culture, which is highly vernacular and highly contextual. You need to have that kind of grounding to be able to decode and to filter this experience.
Well, let's look at some experiences that you've had. You've done over the years a number of collaborations with visual artists.
Sure.
And how challenging has that been?
Honestly, it hasn't been very challenging. It's been quite rewarding. And it's been an education for me to learn something more about visual art. Just recently, it wasn't exactly a collaboration, but I wrote a poem in response to an exhibition at the National Museum of African Art by a Malian artist named Abdoulaye Konaté, who I actually know back in Mali. And and the poem won their Divine Comedy contest. And it was a beautiful experience. And I was able to go send that poem back to him. And he really felt good that people outside of Mali are looking at his work and having an experience with it. Mm-hmm. But it's been a beautiful experience. I learned something new with every collaboration.
You did one some time ago with Ulysses Marshall.
Yes. That was a beautiful experience out at the Prince George's African American. He is an amazing artist. He's very prolific. He probably paints more than any artist that I've ever seen. That was an amazing experience because we were able to also include the community in that. So we actually had people in the community come and respond to the paintings.
In what way?
We had them write haiku about what they were seeing. Just something short and very distilled and focused and then we had them come back to the museum to be a part of an open mic that we did so that people could share what they were experiencing as they moved through. And that was with John Westbay when he was over at the Prince George's, African American Museum.
In 2014, also, you worked with the photographer Don Camp.
Yeah, so that was a project, another commission project, the 5x5 project. Curator A.M. Weaver out of Philadelphia chose one of my poems, Seven Ways of Looking at of Black Flowers. She chose that poem and paired it with an image by Don Camp, and then we kind of like... We kind of came up with this piece, to present as a mural, which caused a little bit of controversy.
The controversy is good. You know, I want to talk about what happens when an African-American male like yourself steps outside of the U.S. You mentioned being in Mali. I want to talk to you about what you were doing also in Belfast, Ireland.
Sure.
What happens when you leave the country?
Well, I think it depends on where you go. And I think it depends on how you approach your travel. So for me, you know, I was just trying to approach it as an open slate, try not to bring whatever kind of baggage that I had. Well, one thing, my travels in Belfast, I learned what it was like to feel neutral for the first time.
How did you get to Belfast?
I think it was 2007, the Smithsonian Folklife Festival had Northern Ireland as one of their focused areas. And so that brought the cultural attaché from Northern Ireland, the Arts Council of Northern Ireland, a photographer and a poet. And they came to Anacostia, and John Westbay and I were already doing readings and putting events on in Anacostia. And so I paired up with that photographer, and there was a pretty well-known Northern Irish writer from Derry. I think she's from Derry. She had some kind of issue and she left. And so they looked to me and said, well, we would like you to take her place and pull together this workshop of poets and respond to these photographs. And so that's how that happened. The cultural attaché from the Arts Council of Northern Ireland saw this exhibition. We put on an exhibition of photography and poetry. They saw the exhibition and they said, we're going to bring you guys to Northern Ireland to do this. And that started a partnership that lasted 5 years. I went back to Northern Ireland sometimes twice in a year, but at least once a year between 2007 and 2012 to do not just, it started to extend beyond just photography and poetry. That was the vehicle, but, you know, I was in an experience where I was I brought together people on both sides of that divide. And I was facilitating it. I was working with community organizations on the ground where I brought together intergenerational groups of people to talk about their experiences with one another. You know, these old kind of like paramilitary guys were talking to the youth and saying, hey, don't get involved in this stuff. The troubles are over. Move on. Get your education. Let's not get involved with this. And so it was interesting as a black man, as a black American man, to be, you know, I was also working cross community on both sides of the wall. right? So to be a black American, to be an African American man and be playing mediator, I think represents an opportunity for African American men, for black men in America. We don't realize the kind of cultural capital that we carry with us when we move places. It's not just because we're rappers and all of that kind of stuff. It also may be the kind of influence that we can have on people.
And you have the world stage, you know.
We have the world stage. And so that was an incredible experience for me, because what it allowed me to see is that, hey, I have something that's valuable for these folks. And they're listening to me in a way that they're not listening to people that are in their communities.
Now, how is this experience changing you?
It definitely changed me, because first of all, it also changed my ideas about race. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not saying, you know, Northern Ireland was some kind of like utopia for race, but to be in a place as an African American to not be part of the central problem freed me up in a way.
You sound like an African American soldier in World War One.
It freed me up in a way to say, you know what, I'm not part of the conflict all the time. Mm-hmm. And that was liberating. That was really liberating. You know, my travels and time in Mali have a different kind of thing.
Well, let's go back to Ireland.
Okay, sure, sure.
There's certain countries that when you mention them, like mm-hmm. Ireland and mm-hmm. and France, that there's just a literary tradition that's there.
I mean, poetry and song and music are just, it's just a part of the, it's in the ether there.
I remember Baraka talking about, you know, we call our departments English department, they should be Irish departments.
Irish departments, yeah, in that poem, in the tradition. He's right. Like, he has that part where he's screaming, he's like, them Irish.
Right, right.
You know, that's what he said.
Right.
No, you can't help but feel it. There's always a song, there's always a saying, some kind of like quick-witted poetic thing that some people say to you walking down the street when you're in a pub sharing a pint with somebody. Or
you're in a pub sharing a pint. Look at you, Ray.
No, but it's true. There's right, always right. There's always something. And the interesting thing about Northern Ireland in particular is that there's this real urge to try to maintain the Gaelic language. So there's a vernacular culture under it too. That's part of the reason why DC and Belfast were chosen to kind of like mesh together, because DC also has a vernacular culture that's striving to stay alive as the city becomes something else, right? So that's one of the things that, you know, the photographer that we work with, Mervyn Smith, when he came here, people were asking him crazy questions like, were you afraid to be in Anacostia as a big, tall, you know, Irish, you know, very white looking man? And he was like, those projects over there, those look just like the estate housing that we have in Belfast. He's like, those people are, I can deal with those people the same way I deal with the people in the estates where I live. He's like, I feel more at home here than I do in the UK.
Well, do you come back with more of a class analysis?
No, I mean, class is there. Mm-hmm. I definitely see that because, yeah, you see the way that people are living in public housing, estate housing in Northern Ireland, and the way that they're living here. And it's strikingly similar. I have pictures of how strikingly similar the architecture is, the kind of like the topography, the way it's laid out. So you see that, but it's not just that, because as an African American, as a black man, to be in a place where, like I said, where you're neutral, where you're not part of the problem, keeps me conscious of race in a way that does not allow me to just focus on class solely. It's there because the similarities are there, but I'm still kind of grappling with the American conception of race and how I'm neutral in that situation. So it's all of that.
And would I begin to see that in your work?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, so I wrote a poem called Sovereignty. That's definitely kind of dealing with that. And there are things that I'm working on a small little manuscript of poems called Blue and Green, which deal with my time in Northern Ireland and deal with some of those similarities.
Okay, well, we're going to take a blue moment right now.
Okay.
And pause. You're listening to On the Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Fred Joyner, and this is WPFW.
Hi, I'm Brandon Miles, and this is your WPFW Social Justice Calendar for the Washington metro area. Thursday, April 28th, the Clarion Call will host a town hall on mass incarceration to discuss prison prevention and exploring options to the current mass incarceration syndrome in the United States at the Fine and Performing Arts Center, 14,000 Jericho Park Road, Bowie, Maryland, at Bowie State University from 6 to 9 p.m. For more information and to register, visit theclariancall.info or call 301-464-7305. Friday, April 29th, the Woodson Banneker Jackson Bay Division 330 UNIA ACL will host the forum on Haiti Freedom is Not Free. Panelists Felipe Latortu and Paul Pumphrey will discuss history and contemporary issues of Haiti. 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Umoja House, 2015 Bunker Hill Road, Northeast. For more information, visit uniadivision330.org or call 301-789-4784. Saturday, April 30th, the Northern Virginia section of the National Council of Negro Women will hold a fair to promote health education, disease prevention, and health care access for members of the local community with free blood pressure screenings, 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. at James Lee Community Center, 2855 Annandale Road, Falls Church, Virginia. For more information, visit Nova Section at novancnw.org or call 703-521-7887. Sunday, May 1st, Ujamaa School will celebrate 48 years of teaching education with African culture at Howard University Blackburn Center from 2 to 5 p.m. The keynote speaker will be Dr. Umar Johnson, renowned psychologist. Ujamaa African dancers and drummers will perform in a vegetarian meal served. Tickets can be purchased at Ujamaa School. For more information, call 202-232-2997. If you'd like your social justice event included in the social justice calendar, visit the webpage ips-dc.org/social-justice-calendar, where you will find submission guidelines. The Social Justice Calendar is a public service brought to you by the Institute for Policy Studies in partnership with WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
Okay, we're back on the margin. I'm Ethelbert Miller, and my guest today is Fred Joyner. Fred Joyner is a poet. He's also the co-founder of the Center for Poetic Thought. Right before our break, Fred, we were talking about, you know, Belfast, and we were talking about your writing there, and I thought it would be good to share some poetry with our audience. I know that there's one book that you were in that's very important to Washington, D.C. literary history, and that's Kim Roberts' anthology, Full Moon on K Street, poems about Washington, D.C., and you have a poem in there entitled Song for Anacostia.
Yes. Song for Anacostia. The 94 hums up the rough side of Stanton. Open windows blare, drums in the pocket, the breakdown of a perfect D.C. groove. Washington's solo view. The 90 salsas across town into the forgotten bottom of D.C. A car alarm echoing its protest on MLK. Two porch griots wailing their pain and pity. Two preachers can be heard through sanctuary walls, one reading scripture, the other raptured in a moan. The smell of last night's first drink poured out in a crooning ballad for the missed and the missing. A song for a father. A song for a mother unchilded. A song for a child playing ahead of the beat. A nursery rhyme for every teddy bear rooted at a street sign. This is the sound of the blues breaking the broken back together. The sound of chaos organizing. The sound. This is the sound, these are the sounds gathered in blood, shed for the remission of silence and sadness.
Fred Joyner reading Song for Anacostia, which is in the book Full Moon on K Street. When you read that, that's an older poem.
It is.
Right? How do you look at your work? I mean, you just read that. We talked earlier about the city changing. Mm-hmm. You know, you pick up this poem and you're talking about the neighborhood you grew up with. Is there something that when you, it's sort of a form of being, you know, is this nostalgia?
There is a nostalgia there because, so I started writing this poem when I moved to, east of the river, I started to learn the community. I would walk to the metro, and it was probably about 5 or 6 blocks. And I moved there in the winter, but I started really settling in during the summer. And so, you know, I would hear these sounds coming out just all over the place. There's a lot of music. In DC in general, there's a lot of sound and music in any city. And so this poem comes from things that I was hearing. And then I was going to a church, at the time I was going to a church. And so I would walk from where I lived in a little section called Hillsdale down to Anacostia proper, to go to church. And this poem started out of that experience. You know, I no longer go to that church. You know, I'm kind of evolved in a way that, that church set me on a way that, and you know, that experience set me on a way that put me in other places spiritually. And so, yeah, there is a nostalgia there because I go back to all those places. Like I can tell you walking down the street, that's almost like a soundscape. Like, another DC artist, Kokai, just did recently for another station. You know, it's a soundscape. I can literally walk down the street and point you to where I heard what I call Washington's group, where I heard some go-go out of the, you know, and then heard some, you know, other music coming out of these windows or different things that I heard as I was walking down the street or saw.
How important is, you know, a poem like what you've just written, how important is in a book like this to be in our school so that if I'm a young kid growing up, you know, I read your poem about Anacostia?
I think that it's very important, and because the city is changing. You know, before this show started, we were talking about the archive, right? And documentation. What I hope for this poem and for poems like it that deal with that are looking at parts of the city or phenomenon in the city that are no longer happening because the city's inhabitants are not here or the institutions are not here anymore. I hope that the poem is a pointer to say, hey, this is talking about something that may not actually be here anymore, something that still informs who and what the city is. And so, and also as a student, as a young student, it's important to see your neighborhood talked about in a way that's not necessarily what you always see on the news. You know, it's not always the shooting that happened or the, you know, it's the beautiful things that come out of it. Now, the poem may have some hurt, you know, painful things in it. But what I hope the poem also accomplishes is to, when you look at it as an object, I hope that it's a beautiful thing that came out of that experience. And I think that it's important for students to be able to see that.
Well, here's some more beautiful thing. I think you have some additional poems.
Yeah, I have. So this is a poem called Currency. Currency. A pocket can sometimes be a kind of prison. I have never lived in a cash economy where the billfold unfolds to find someone creased in the middle. But perhaps credit moves the same way, the way it scores the pocket and the body, boxed and bureaued. The edge of a card cuts anything akin to skin. A dollar, a euro, a World Bank, a debt to erase, a weight, a race, a weight.
Fred Joyner, our poet on the margin today. Fred, let's talk about Mali. We were talking about Belfast, Northern Ireland. Let's move to Mali, which mm-hmm. is also where you're spending time today. What took you to Mali?
So my wife took a job.
You got married.
I got married, and my wife took a job in Bamako, Mali, doing public health work, malaria prevention, basically rolling out the malaria program for the entire country of Mali. And just for a frame of reference, Mali is probably, I'm not sure the exact number, but it's probably at least the size of about 2.5 Texases.
And malaria is still a serious
issue. And malaria is still a serious issue there. So we got married, and we decided, for her career and for my own kind of like, for our own experience together, this was a good thing to do. And so we left, I left a little bit later because I wanted to attend the Furious Flower, the last Furious Flower conference. So I attended Furious Flower, and then I went and met her and Molly, and I've been there pretty much ever since.
You know, maybe you can be our eyewitness. Many times when we pick up the newspaper today, Molly's in the news because of Boko Haram and Islamic fundamentalism. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's your take of things that you've been experiencing? Has there been a concern about your family's safety?
Or
is that in the northern part of Mali?
In the northern part of Mali, it's been that way a long time. It's just recently kind of like, as certain things have happened, as our coalition initiatives in the region, in the Middle East, and how all these things have kind of started to affect other things that are happening. You know, you hear about the presence of Gaddafi and the non-presence of Gaddafi and how that's affecting Northern Africa and Western Central Africa. That's there. So those kinds of things are real in the North right now. They've intensified because things have been shifting. So, and recently, you know, there was a very big attack at the Radisson Hotel in Bamako where, it was bad. They were specifically looking, from what I've heard, the reports that I've seen, they were specifically looking for Air France flight crew members. Mm-hmm. They didn't find them, but so that's also shifting the way things are happening. And just recently, a few weeks ago, there was an attack in Abidjan, or Grand Bassam in Ivory Coast. So there's all these things that are happening. Yeah, I am concerned for our family. That's kind of like one of the things that we're thinking about is like, do we extend, you know, to stay another 2 years? But the challenge is this: as a black man, as an African American man, you know, I think about some of the engagements with law enforcement. I think about the engagements with other citizens who see themselves as people policing the community, and sometimes I feel like there's a certain kind of danger I'm in here as well.
Well, so, you know, you were talking recently, I mean, just a few minutes ago about Belfast.
Yeah. Race. Yeah. Yeah. So it, I mean, for some reason, it seems like I found my way into the teeth of these kinds of conflicts. But one of the things I really want to be honest with myself about is like, what kind of danger am I really in? And the family, what kind of danger are we really in? Because when you talk to the Malian people, they are heartbroken about this. And it's not just a thing of like, oh, why do they hate us? This is not, they're really heartbroken because part of their culture is hospitality. And so now if they don't have an opportunity to display this hospitality, they wonder about what's going to happen to their country.
You know, when I look at you, Fred, I'm looking at what happens when the writer, you know, steps out onto this world stage that we were talking about. I'm looking at how that might affect you in terms of genre. You've been sharing some of your poems with us. Mm. But I wonder whether now perhaps one looks to Fred Joyner for the essay.
And, you know, it's
or the novel.
It's funny that you mention that because another poet friend of mine, Kevin Simmons, was recently in town for the Split This Rock conference, and he sat me down and said, he was talking to me just like you are about my experiences in Northern Ireland, my experiences in Mali, and he was like, wait, stop. He was like, why am I not seeing this in print somewhere? He's like, I understand you're a poet, but what about just, you know, an essay, you know, a lyric essay or an essay or something. To document this. And so his kind of like prodding is helping me start to think about how I might assemble this, because I do think, you know, poetry is a world that us poets, we like to enter and deal with. But sometimes maybe the essay is another way to reach folks with a population, an audience, with the same kind of ideas, but just with a different kind of delivery. So it's something that I'm definitely thinking about, because I think, you know, some of the ideas that I want to deal with, I don't want to deal with just in poetry. I want to have more space, to deal with those things and to speak in a different fashion about them. So it's coming.
Now, aren't you also like a visual artist?
I am.
I don't really talk about that.
Well, you know, I just finished an interview with another organization. And then, so I was going through a transition in my writing when I was starting to think about doing an MFA and just kind of like some of the reading that I was doing, some really awesome reading with, you know, studying poets. And I was like, so I was going through a transition, and the visual art was a way. I had a studio in my place. I had one larger bedroom in my place that was my studio. I had old magazines. I had paint. I had some photographs that I had taken. I took out all of my books, all of my like poetry books. I took all that stuff out, but left like this raw material. And I had these canvases that I would put up on the wall, and I would be making like three or four kind of like paintings / collages at the same time. And so the visual art came out of kind of putting a damper on the writing, or just slowing down with the writing to figure out what I wanted to do next. The visual art came out of that experience, trying to like just figure out different ways to express ideas. And it was also a way for me to learn about visual art, other visual artists that I was really interested in. I mean, obviously, when you say collage, you can't talk about collage and not talk about Romare Bearden, right? But I was, you know, Rauschenberg. I was also thinking about Rauschenberg. I was thinking about, like, I mean, just a lot of people, digital artists who were creating these kind of digital collages in, you know, in this contemporary moment that we're in. So it was a way for me to engage with that and to also stay creative.
Well, let's talk about something, because I didn't mention this on here. But, you know, at one time we saw you as the IT guy.
So my background is in mathematics and information technology. And I did that when I started at American University, when I transferred to American University in 1994. I did that, you know, my first work study job was an IT job. Mm-hmm. And so I've been doing that up until 2000. When I got laid off right before I moved to Mali from the organization that I was working for. And I did that, it's, you know, that was over 20 years. Mm-hmm. So I did that for 20 years. And I had the kind of, you know, I had these two trains running in a way. Like I had my IT career. And then when I left, you know, when I left in the evening, you know, I was going to readings or I was going to workshops, or I was, you know, going to play coffee shops with my friends, sitting around talking about poems, or, you know, would go to busboys or like.
But these two trains came into a station, and that station was the Center for Poetic Thought. So why did you create that organization?
Well, because it provided a way for me to do similar work that I was doing with the American Poetry Museum as their curator and public programs kind of person. But it also allowed for me to do projects that may not necessarily be part of American Poetry Museum's mission. So John Westbay and I partnered to create this space to do things like small theater, right? That still use the poetic impulse. You know, we're working with a few different artists right now to do, you know, one person shows in this little 500 square foot space. You know, one of the things that I'm really excited that I'd really like to do is to do something about architecture and language and architecture and poetry. And, you know, so these are things that are dealing with the poetic impulse, but aren't necessarily poetry that occurs in a spoken way or on the page. Like it is a space to try to engage different ways that we find the poetic impulse as it occurs in out in the world, as we experience poetry, not just the thing that happens on the page or in the spoken realm, right? So that's
what's happening in your house. I mean, your children are very young, but I assume you have a blueprint in terms of how you're going to introduce literature to them.
Yeah, well, you know, so when we had my first daughter Naomi, I bought a book. I was in a used bookstore and I saw this book, and it was about a bogolan cloth. Mud cloth is what we call it here, right? And I was like, I'm getting this book. Now, my daughter was like 3 months old at the time, right? But I bought this book for her and I started reading it to her at three months. And so for me, it's like, and not only that, but even before that, like, you know, my father's a musician. So, and specifically a jazz musician. So I was playing, you know, in the womb. You know, my wife is not such a big jazz fan, but I was playing music for Naomi in the womb, right? And not just jazz, but other things. But, you know, so to me, yeah, the blueprint is like, and is yes, sharing literature as early as they can focus their eyes.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was reading, Ta-Nehisi Coates was talking about, you know, moving to France, which he did, and giving his child the opportunity, you know, to learn another language. I think
absolutely.
That's happening in your household also.
Absolutely. So so that my daughter, we have a nanny back in Mali. Awa is her name, and she only speaks French. So, and she speaks to her totally in French, no English. And so that's forced me to get my language skills together to try to continue that. Even while we're there and while we're here, my wife is fluent in French. But to me, the language, that is very important, because I want my daughters to feel like they're citizens of the world. You know, my daughter also understands probably just a little bit of Bambara as well, because the people that work around the compound that we live in, they speak Bambara. Or what the name of the language is Bamanankan is what Malians call it, but French and other Westerners, we call it Bambara. So yeah, I want them to feel like citizens of the world, and language is a part of that.
About the citizen, because we're going from like Anacostia to Africa.
And
I wonder about how, you know, growing up here, how you saw Africa the first time. I mean, I can pick up the Big C and Langston's talking about, you know, that first experience, mm-hmm. that first encounter. Mm-hmm. What was it for you?
I had an uncle who died just a few years ago now. His name was Clemson Joyner. We called him, I called him Uncle Russell. And he was a Vietnam vet. He didn't fully come back from the war. Probably post-traumatic stress, some kind of mental condition, but he had a photographic memory. So he would, in his travels and in his time in Philadelphia, he's born and raised Philadelphian, you know, he would see different prints from West Africa, mud cloth, different textiles, and he was able to draw those things from memory. And the first time he was teaching me about maps, I was probably about 8 years old, and he showed me that the Sahara Desert was larger than the United, was about the same size as the United States. He had these little transparencies that he put the map over it, you know, when it was to scale, you know? Mm-hmm. And that for me was the first time that I had any kind of like training in exposure to Africa. Now, on top of that, or consciously, I'll say that consciously. Now, in my house, my dad had sculptures that he had acquired in his travels. He had paintings. We had books. So all these things were kind of like, were my first exposure, to Africa in the house, in my family experience. That was my first exposure.
You know, when you take that first exposure and you look at our city, what is your hope in terms of, you know, the vision that you have for DC?
I hope that we can, even as the city changes, right? We know that the market and the economy changes things, but my hope is that those of us who are out here that are cultural workers will fight to can maintain the cultural. Let's make sure that the history doesn't get lost, that the archive, the documentation, because cities are going to change. It's going to be different 20 years from now, and it's cyclical. But let's, instead of fighting for things that are already controlled by big money, let's make sure that we control the narrative around certain things. That's why poets and writers are important. Let's control the narrative. Let's control the cultural history around these things, so that we make sure that those stories are told right.
Okay.
Correctly.
And that's why Fred Joyner, my guest, is important. Thank you for being on The Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3.
Thank you for having me.
Join the jazz community as we band together in lobbying the D.C. government to include jazz and live music programming in their cultural, economic, and city planning. We're lobbying for incentives to businesses for live music programming, public-private partnerships, affordable housing for artists, a government public awareness push behind Jazz Appreciation Month and International Jazz Day. Share our event page, D.C. Jazz Lobbying Days, on Facebook. Copy the letter to send to your city council member and help hold our officials accountable as we fight to save not only jazz music, but an industry and the live music economy.
On Tuesday, May 3rd at 7 p.m., the Goethe Institute, in partnership with WPFW, invites you to an audio evening featuring a new project about Elsa Knight Thompson, one of Pacifica Radio's pioneers working for many years at KPFA Berkeley in the 50s and the 1960s. German producer Martina Gross will present her award-winning work on Thompson. This program is organized in cooperation with Here Now, an informal group of local producers and radiophiles that present cutting-edge listening experiences and discussions, as well as a chance to hear what's going on in public radio across the country and around the world. To RSVP, visit goethe-institute-washington.eventbrite.com. The event will take place at WPFW, 1990 K Street, Northwest Washington, your home for jazz and justice.
WPFW is proud to be the media sponsor for the 12th Annual Green Festival, May 6th through the 8th at the D.C. Convention Center. Shop, taste, and enjoy everything you need to live a more substantial lifestyle with thousands of green brands. Free admission for mom all weekend in celebration of Mother's Day, May 8th. Taste local vegan and vegetarian food and vegetables and beverages. Hear music by some of DMV's most talented artists on the WPFW Live at 5 stage. There's something for everyone to enjoy, including free yoga sessions, educational and inspirational presentations from well-known chefs and substantial fashion designers, viewings of the Netflix hit Conspiracy, and pet adoptions through the Green Festival Save Lives campaign. Visit the D.C. Department of Parks and Recreation Family Fun Area, which will be packed with learning activities for the whole family. Ride your bike to the D.C. Green Festival, bring your helmet to the box office, and receive free admission. Join us May 6th, 7th, and 8th for the Green Festival Expo at the D.C. Convention Center. Visit greenfestival.org for more information and ticket specials. Shop, taste, hear, and enjoy.
Have you ever considered producing a community radio show? If that's the case, please pay attention. The Pacifica National Board has approved a motion to implement 5 new hours of programming in Spanish per week at every station of Pacifica, which includes Houston, Los Angeles, Berkeley, Washington, D.C., and New York. If you or someone you know is interested, please send us an email to programacion-espanol@pacifica.org or visit your local Pacifica Radio website.